according to authorities. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Potentially, we have been killing over 550 billion insects since the beginning of the year. However, the threat remains real. As we have a new generation breeding now.
That's Cyril Farrand of the UN Food and Agriculture Organization on the likelihood of a second generation of locusts in East Africa. Details coming up also. The largest Ebola outbreak in the Eastern DRC has been declared over after nearly 2 years and more than 2,200 deaths. And Malawi's Electoral Commission has started announcing preliminary results from Tuesday's rerun election. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Several countries in East Africa are facing yet another wave of desert locust infestation as second-generation swarms continue to form in the region. The bulk are expected to hit the northern Kenya and spread through Ethiopia, South Sudan, and Somalia in the coming weeks. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
In Kenya, billions of locusts are now found in the semi-arid northern counties of Turkana and Marsabit, posing a considerable threat to crops and pastures. Cyril Ferrand is the resilient team leader for East Africa at the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO.
The three most affected countries remain Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya. In these three countries, we have had quite a lot of control operations, quite successful in Kenya, to the point that we have been reducing the number of infested counties from 30 counties to only two counties remaining now, counties of Marsabit and Turkana.
From Kenya, officials say the swarms will migrate northwards to the summer breeding areas in Sudan and Ethiopia, where they will mature quickly and lay eggs. Some farmers like George Kanyi are worried.
Sasa sisi tuko na hofu kubwa sana sababu hizo nzige tunasikia zinaweza rudi na zikirudi sasa sisi.
He says we are concerned because we hear there is a new wave of locusts that will likely strike again, and if that happens it will be devastating.
Kirudi sasa sisi tutakuwa tumeja kabisa.
Verand says the new locust outbreak is likely to threaten food supplies in a region already reeling from floods and the impact of COVID-19. The spraying of pesticides launched in February has seen locust infestations decline rapidly as a result of control operations, as the FAO official explains.
We have been controlling by now, or treating by now, close to 500,000 hectares altogether. Potentially, we have been killing over 550 billion insects since the beginning of the year. However, the threat remains real as we have a new generation breeding now. In Kenya, the second breeding generation will be leaving towards Sudan.
In May, the World Bank approved $500 million to help countries in East Africa deal with the problem. In Ethiopia, control operations continue against upper bands and new swarms that are forming in the east and northeast. Smaller operations are underway in central and northern Somalia. Kenneth Kemushi Mwangi is a satellite information analyst from the IGAD Climate Prediction and Application Center.
The damage so far has been very heavy in Ethiopia and central and northern Somalia. In Ethiopia, already from the first wave and part of a second wave, 1.3 million hectares of grazing land was already affected. 200,000 hectares of crops was already affected. In Somalia, we're expecting even a larger damage because there's conflict in Somalia. There's also the COVID-19.
The UN says some hopper bands from Yemen are likely to migrate to northern Somalia and northeast Ethiopia. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The second largest Ebola outbreak on record has been declared over after nearly 2 years and more than 2,200 deaths. Reuters quoted the Democratic Republic of Congo's health minister, Eteni Longondo, as saying the outbreak was the country's longest, most complex, and deadliest. The DRC has suffered 11 Ebola outbreaks since the virus was discovered near the Ebola River in 1976. This one in the country's east took place in a conflict zone that complicated international efforts to eradicate it. Today's good news, however, according to the Associated Press, is being overshadowed by enormous health challenges still facing the Congo, the world's largest measles epidemic, the rising threat of COVID-19, and another new Ebola outbreak in the north. Malawi's Electoral Commission has started announcing preliminary results from Tuesday's rerun of last year's tainted presidential election. Malawi's media yesterday gave opposition leader Lazarus Chakwera a comfortable 55% of the votes to incumbent president Peter Mutharika's 40%. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In a court-sanctioned rerun, President Mutharika, leader of the Democratic Progressive Party, is running against Lazarus Chakwera, leader of the opposition Malawi Congress Party, and little known Peter Kuwani of the opposition Mbakuwaku Movement for Democracy. Announcing the results at the Mentale Center Thursday in Blantyre, Electoral Commission Chairperson Chifundo Kachale said the commission had received results from 26 of the country's 28 districts. He read out returns from three districts, Chiradzulu, Mwanza, and Likoma, which were the first to submit their counted ballots to the tally center.
The results for Likoma, the MCP candidate Lazarus Chakwera got 2,981 votes, and Peter Dominico Sinos Driver Kuani for MMD got 37 votes, while Arthur Peter Mutharika of the DPP got 1,690 votes.
In results from other two districts, President Mutharika was leading, while Chakwera came second and Kuwani last. Kachale said as of Thursday morning, the commission had finished verifying results from about one-fifth of the districts and promised to complete the rest soon.
We continue to emphasize that we are committed to get this job done as soon as possible. We wouldn't want to create any anxiety by delaying this process needlessly. You have our greatest commitment that come this evening, you shall see significant progress in the number of districts that we managed to clear.
However, Malawian media, including the state-owned Malawi Broadcasting Corporation, said Chakwera had a strong lead with 55% of the vote compared to 40% for Mutharika. Ezineho Nkaka is the Secretary General of the MCP. He told VOA the party does not expect changes from the figures that local media announced because those figures reflect vote totals the party collected from its monitors across the country.
There could be some slight changes because, unlike in the past, what the commission is now doing, according to the law, is to look at the null and void votes. So in some cases, they are determining that, no, this shouldn't have been a null and void. There might be some small changes, but not material enough to change anything.
VOA could not reach DPP officials for comment, but the party's spokesperson, Nicholas Dausi, told a local radio station Thursday that he will comment after official final results are announced. The Malawi Electoral Commission is expected to announce final results within 8 days from the day of voting, as required by the law. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Ethiopia's announcement that it will start filling its massive Blue Nile Dam project next month has sparked anger in Egypt, and the dispute has reached the United Nations Security Council. William Davison, the International Crisis Group senior analyst for Ethiopia, spoke to VOA Salem Solomon and begins by explaining the role of international community has played so far.
The latest situation is that The process is now focused around the United Nations Security Council. And that's because negotiations resumed on the 9th of June, but then they broke up again on the 17th of June without an agreement. And just a couple of days later, Egypt wrote its second letter to the Security Council, this time asking for an urgent meeting on the matter and calling the GERD and the situation around it as a potential threat to international peace and security. Ethiopia has replied, rejecting all of these allegations. But the point is, at the moment, we're not in the negotiations, and instead it's this sort of process of diplomatic escalation. And it was in the aftermath of the latest breakdown of negotiations that we had this intervention from the National Security Council in a tweet. I think it should be noted, we haven't seen too many other signs of a US government taking a position in the last few days. So at the moment, the tweet is somewhat isolated. But the claim and the position that the NSC seemed to be expressing there was something along the lines of the Egyptian position, that it was Ethiopian intransigence which has prevented the parties from coming to an agreement. Now, as you can imagine, there's a great deal of claim and counterclaim over that. But what we can say is that in the last round of negotiations, the issue that the process most prominently stumbled on was legal issues, and that was relating to whether the agreement that they were trying to sign is going to be legally binding or not. Now, there's a lot more detail behind that, but essentially Egypt and Sudan disagreed, opposed the Ethiopian position that it would not be a fully binding international treaty.
Why has it escalated to this level? And would taking it to the Security Council resolve the issue?
There's two ways of answering that. One would be to explain what Egypt's trying to do. The other would be to give my own crisis group's view on it. I think obviously what Egypt is trying to do is to rally as much international support for its position, including most prominently and most obviously from the US government. It seems to think that international pressure, whether from the UNSC or whether from related activity stemming from it being raised internationally, Egypt seems to think that that will either get Ethiopia to pause its filling plans or get Ethiopia to sign an agreement, which it otherwise was not willing to do. Now, as far as we are concerned at Crisis Group, there is no evidence for that. There is no suggestion that Ethiopia is not going to fill the Renaissance Dam, to start filling the Renaissance Dam next month. There is also no sign, no clear sign, that Ethiopia is willing to submit to increased international pressure on this matter. And in fact, there are plenty of signs that Ethiopia is set up, is in the mood to resist any further international pressure on this matter, because of course we saw plenty of pressure from the US government earlier in the year. So Egypt is following a policy of diplomatic escalation to try and increase the pressure, but it isn't really clear to outside observers why they think that that is going to be a successful strategy given their stated aims here.
That was William Davison, the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for Ethiopia, speaking with VOA's Salem Salomon. South Africa this week became the first African country to begin trialing a vaccine against COVID-19. The test will involve 2,000 volunteers and the first participant has been enrolled. The World Health Organization says hundreds of medical teams around the world are working towards an immunization and it welcomes Africa's participation in the search. Darren Taylor reports.
Professor Helen Rees chairs the Africa Regional Immunization Advisory Group for the World Health Organization. She's also one of the scientists involved in testing a possible vaccine. In addition, Rees is part of the International Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, or CEPI. It was established in 2017 after several Ebola outbreaks in West Africa. Rees explains that CEPI develops vaccines against emerging pathogen threats.
The early vaccines that were in development came from the Northern Hemisphere. They were developed in China, they were developed in the UK, in the US, and from more developed economies who were able to change rapidly and look at their own technologies and move into vaccine development.
Almost all the current 270 trials to find a COVID-19 vaccine are in the world's richer countries. Rees says this can't continue.
We really need to have vaccines tried and tested throughout the world in all populations. And there are several reasons for that. One is that we want to know if vaccines are safe and effective in all populations. And to do that, we need to then have this global spread.
The second reason, she says, is to allow everyday people to contribute towards curing coronavirus, not just scientists.
If you talk to people participating in trials, they'll often say, the reason I want to do it is because I want to give back. Or I know somebody who had that disease and I want to protect. I don't want to see that happening again.
Rees points out that COVID-19 is a threat to everyone, everywhere.
And because this is a global pandemic, there needs to be that opportunity for many people around the world to be able to express that solidarity and that global altruism.
But this isn't happening, she says. Instead, there's vaccine nationalism.
In fact, vaccine production is being ring-fenced for particular countries. And obviously the richer countries and the richer areas are trying to say, my country first and all my citizens first.
Rees argues for immunization to be available to everyone, no matter where a vaccine is developed.
There might and will have to be prioritization because the amount of vaccine available to begin with will be limited. And we might have to think about groups such as healthcare workers first. But what we are arguing is that it cannot be my country and my country only first. So what started off...
Rees also refers to an incident in April that caused outrage in Africa. A prominent French doctor suggested that the continent be used as a testing ground for a vaccine. He framed his statement in such a way that many Africans interpreted it to mean that their lives didn't matter as much as, say, Europeans. Rees says this has caused some in Africa to question the value of the continent's participation in vaccine tests.
We have to counter that with the arguments that say, actually, we want to be in trials. We want to participate. We want to be part of this scientific endeavor.
She believes this is a very powerful way to ensure that Africa gets fair access to future vaccines. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The cost of living in Zimbabwe continues to increase following a series of price increases, adding to inflation that has eroded incomes. The latest price hike is fuel, which was increased by 150%. Kuzazi Nwashi has the details.
Neshin Mudzitirwa is the spokesperson of Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe. He bemoans the recent price increases.
The prices of goods and services have skyrocketed due to the announcement of the 50% salary increase and COVID allowance by the government to its workers. This has totally eroded our little-end income. We haven't yet received the 50% salary increment and the COVID allowance.
He says their civil service salaries have been eroded before they have even received them. Mudzitirwa says the announcement of the salary increase and the recent creation of a new foreign currency auction system are adding to the price hikes. Fuel prices rose by 150% this week after the government ended its fixed rate exchange system for the country's currency, the RTGS dollar. Instead, the currency will be traded through a weekly auction. Eddie Cross is an economist and a member of the Central Bank's Monetary Policy Committee.
The rapid increase in retail prices over the past 2 years, well, 18 months really, has been principally driven by the depreciation in the local currency. We've gone from where the local currency was equal to $1 at the beginning of 2019, where today it's trading in the open market at about 100 to 1.
He adds the exchange rate needs to be controlled, but he does not foresee that happening in the short term. In the meantime, he says there is need for salary reviews.
Well, it depends on how quickly they adjust wages, because if wages keep pace with inflation, then it simply means that we balance the economy again. What's happening now is that the wages do not get pace with inflation, and therefore the average Zimbabwean is very much worse off than he was a year ago.
Cross says the bulk of foreign currency has been traded in the black market, and that has driven inflation. But the recently introduced auction system for foreign exchange will change that. Zimbabwe's economy has been battered over the past few years by drought and shortages of currency and foreign exchange, which led to inflation and shortages of food, medicines, and fuel. The inflation has topped 700% in recent months. The COVID-19 pandemic has added to the economic woes, as international trade and domestic commerce have slowed, while the government struggles to pay for healthcare needs. For VOA, this is Kudza Nawashe from Harare.
For weeks, the United States has seen daily protests against racism sparked by the death of George Floyd in the U.S. city of Minneapolis, Minnesota, in May. Floyd, a black man, died after a police officer held his knee on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. Protesters continue demanding an end to police violence and equal treatment before the law. Their grievances are supported by a majority of Americans and have already inspired many cities and state governments to rethink how police do their jobs and the damage racism causes in the United States. We talked with several immigrants from Africa to hear their thoughts on the protests and the problem that fueled them. Today and tomorrow, we'll share their comments. Joe Tolu Olu, a Nigerian-American who lives in Wake Forest, North Carolina, says the problems that protesters are angry about are real concerns for him, and he has spoken to his three sons about the repeated reports of police violence against black men in the U.S.
They have to realize whom they are, because they are double minority. They are black. And their parents is a foreign black, even though they were born here. So they are double minority. And I advise them that they should not have any argument, even if they are right, with any law enforcement agents, especially the police. At that moment, they have any encounter with the police, they have to obey in totality, because their life is at the mercy of the police officer at that moment.
In New York, Huda Ibrahim, who came to the U.S. from Sudan, says reports of police violence against people of color are a worry for her.
I think maybe one thing that shifted is that now that I've been living here, I've been feeling a little bit more concerned about my own safety, because again, in Sudan, you know, I'm just Sudanese, or I'm just Tubu. I'm not really my skin tone. And in this country, I am black, and that's how people see me walking outside. And just hoping that I don't come in close contact with law enforcement in any way or shape. I mean, it's enough as a Muslim African coming to this country and being stopped at JFK or and being questioned for being Muslim and being taken to a room in the back. I'm not in my surroundings. I'm not with my family. Navigating all of that, it's definitely concerning.
Lamin Sabali, who lives in the northern state of Minnesota, says the United States gave him sanctuary when he came here 18 years ago from the Gambia. He says while he is grateful to live in the United States and says it is a beacon of hope for many, but he says the recent deaths of black Americans at the hands of police and the protests show that some things need to change.
If you look at the disparity between the white population and the minorities in terms of all the sectors of the economy, in terms of education, housing, you know, criminal justice, the way the rules are applied, you know, it's been manifested in the police, the way police are actually treating the minority population, especially the black people. The number of black people, especially unarmed black people that die at the hands of the police, is the statistics are there to speak for itself. So these problems have to be addressed if the United States, you know, want to remain as a beacon of hope.
Sabali, like many American citizens, thinks the United States can do better than it has. Tomorrow, we will bring you more comments from members of the African diaspora on the Black Lives Matter movement. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehigis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaru, thank you for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny.